Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Thursday, April the 4th, 2024, and we continue our podcast profiling the Seat Working Paper series written by Laura Snyder. And therefore, I am joined today by Karen Alpert in Australia and Laura Snyder in Paris. Today, our topic is what should other countries do in response to the U.S. extraterritorial tax regime? What can they do? What should they do? Karen, how are you today?
I'm great, John. Thank you.
Excellent. Laura?
Well, thanks.
All right. Well, Laura, I think it's great that you included this particular topic as part of your working paper series. And in my mind, it sort of plants the seed that as bad as this sort of U.S. Created problem is, other countries are contributing to the problem to a large extent by just kind of acquiescing to the U.S. extraterritorial tax regime, passively accepting it. Is that a fair characterization of your view of this?
Yes. I mean, to a certain extent, some governmental representatives even go further than just passively accepting it. They even seek to entrench it in some way.
All right.
But for the most part, they are passive.
Yeah, you know, that's actually, I think, a good starting point. So not only do other countries accept, but they actually have taken steps to entrench. Interesting point. Karen, what's your view of that?
Yeah, look, whenever we bring it up here in Australia, you know, that Australia should be doing something, it's like they wash their hands of it. It's like, it's not our problem, it's the U.S. problem. Go get them to fix it for you.
How, given the damage that the U.S. extraterritorial tax regime does to the sovereignty of other countries, and in some cases to their treasury, the siphoning capital out of it through the tax system, through the disabling of their own tax residents from being able to engage in normal retirement planning, which is a clear public policy objective, how in the world can any country say that this is, well, just a U.S. problem? I don't quite understand that. Could you help me with that?
Look, their point of view is if you're going to remain a U.S. citizen, you're going to have to deal with the U.S. laws, and they're not going to worry about it. I don't really understand, because I don't think they understand how it hurts their own country. They think it just hurts these Americans. And part of the problem is that they see them as Americans, even though they're mostly dual citizens. And they're all tax residents here. But the way the whole problem is discussed is it's those Americans. And they can go back to America if they don't like it, or they can renounce their citizenship.
Interesting. What do you think, Laura?
Well, it's more than just not being able to save for retirement. You know, it's things we've talked about many times, and that this particular paper also, you know, lists yet again. But, you know, you've got issues with business ownership, investment, home ownership, succession planning, welfare benefits, participation in social organizations. It's a whole range of things that prevent people from fully contributing, meeting their full potential in the places where they live. So it's really not, it is about retirement planning, but not by any means just about retirement planning. And what, you know, yes, it's there's, as this paper talks about at length, yes, the inclination for government officials in other countries is to just, yeah, wipe their hands of it and say, go talk to the United States. And they either can't or won't understand the full impact and problem of this in their countries, and the responsibility as governmental representatives that they have to take action, that they just are completely blind to all of that.
Are they willfully blind or are they just ignorant?
In my opinion, most of them are willfully blind. We've given them plenty of information. Karen has talked about, everything that they've tried to do in Australia. We've ourselves personally met with representatives of the European Union Parliament, and they just shut us down. That's willful.
Is it, as Karen says, the problem that once one has US citizenship, they're no longer really our citizens?
Well, they certainly see everyone who's not an accidental as that way. Certainly. Accidentals, you could debate it.
Well, have they tried to give any help to accidentals?
Well, that's the only people, as far as I can tell, they even profess to even be trying to help, setting aside whether they've, been effective at it. But, for example, the delegation from the European Union that was in Washington, D.C., I guess, what, a couple of years ago now, they were only looking to help accidentals. They could care less about people who weren't accidental.
Well, not only that, not only were they only trying to help accidentals, but they were very, very clear that they didn't want to interfere with U.S. tax policy. At least that's my memory. Is that your memory?
Oh, crystal clear. And this paper talks about that specifically. And in their report, that's what they said. They don't want to interfere with that at all. They're exclusively focused on bank access.
Which I assume you would agree is a huge, huge mistake. In
It's
other
not
words, to
just a
focus on an
mistake.
aspect of the problem rather than the problem.
It's not just a mistake. It's a they are not fulfilling their duties as representatives of their government. They are meant to be protecting, well, the sovereignty of the places that they represent. And these laws violate their sovereignty on many levels. There's the bit where people are being discriminated against based on their nationality. That's a violation of the international treaties they've ascribed to, of their constitutions and their charters. They are allowing people to be discriminated against based on nationality. They are allowing the United States to dictate economic and tax policies for people who live in their countries, interfering with their own policies, which the people of those countries supposedly, in a, if you're talking about a democratic nation, those policies were adopted in, according to the will of the people. And these governmental representatives, their duty is to protect the sovereignty of their country, to make sure that the policies their people want are actually apply in their country. And that's not what's happening here. They are allowing the United States to come in and basically do what they want.
All right, that's interesting, and largely I agree with you, but I'd like to ask of each of you the following question. So we talk about how the extraterritorial U.S. tax regime negatively impacts the sovereignty of other countries. What about the question of should a U.S. citizen resident in one of these countries, even if they're a dual citizen, be allowed to run for public office? Now, before you answer, what prompts this question is this. A couple of elections ago in Canada, it became known close to the actual election that the conservative leader, Andrew Scheer, was a dual citizen, was an American. Dual citizen, American and Canadian. Clearly, I think it's very clear that this was discovered sort of inadvertently, that he had made a decision to not make that part of his biographical detail. Do you think that the fact of his dual citizenship should have been a bar to his A, leading, being the party leader, or B, being able to allowed to run for public office, period? In other words, should U.S. citizens be barred from running for public office in other countries?
So in Australia, we have a rule for federal government representatives that they cannot be dual citizens. They must be only Australian citizens. And we had a bit of a crisis. Oh, but it's been 5, 7 years ago now, where several members of parliament had to lost their positions because it was discovered that they were dual citizens, not of the United States, but of other countries, mainly the UK.
Yeah, one was from Canada, actually. I remember that.
Yeah, one would have been, yeah, that's quite possible, Canadian, but several were UK, given the history of Australia, and the history of citizenship in Australia. So for at the federal level, it's just not allowed. At the state level, it is allowed, and there are representatives in some of the state parliaments who are dual citizens, US citizens. But at the state level, it's not allowed. Or at the federal level, I mean, it's not allowed.
But U.S. citizenship is not like any other citizenship. U.S. citizens, particularly those living out, well, including those living outside the United States, are subject to extremely coercive regulations, reporting fines, penalties, FBAR, this sort of stuff. Do you think that that should be a factor? And I mean, it's one thing to have a blanket ban on, dual citizens. But do you think that U.S. citizens running for public office in other countries presents a special problem because of the tax and the tax regime? Laura, what do you think?
Because of the reporting requirements, yes, I
Yeah,
do.
you do. Laura, what do you think?
I was just imagining an American citizen having responsibility for some sort of state account of another country, and what that reporting would look like.
Yeah.
But isn't it even worse, right? Because you got the problem of, I mean, U.S. citizens always live under threat of penalty, right? Can you really have a high-level government official in another country be even theoretically subject to things like FBAR penalties?
Yeah, no.
I know this is exactly what you were driving at, but it reminds me of Prince Harry living in the United States and what kind of access he would have had to, or he does or did have to any sort of UK account or any sort of the royal family's assets and what that would look like in terms of reporting. God only knows. It'd be a reason to completely cut him off.
It would be a reason to if it were possible to terminate his British citizenship, I think, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but I'm not sure the British citizenship is the problem as much as all the trusts, etc., that he's a beneficiary of.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed. But as a general principle, you would agree that it is a problem for people in political positions outside the United States to have U.S. citizenship.
Yeah.
A lot of countries find dual citizenship, regardless of what the other citizenship is, to be problematic if you've got, a certain level of governmental position. But of course, having a US citizenship brings more problems.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it was very interesting to me that there was no discussion of this aspect of it at all. When this, for a few days, I mean, in Canada it was sort of a big deal. I think really talking about the wrong kinds of things. All right. One of the points that you make in your paper, Lauren, Karen and I discussed this a few days ago. I think that we would all agree that the major culprit here, even more than citizenship taxation, is the saving clauses in the treaties. Agreed?
This is what we've identified as a way for other countries to take action. This is where they have at least one of the more obvious ways that they have some at least ostensible means of control.
Right. Karen, for listeners, could you just briefly outline what the saving clause is and how it works?
Yeah, so most treaty, well, all treaties have a bit in there where they say where there's like a residence tiebreaker, so that you end up being tax resident in only one of the two countries. But the US insists on putting it into all of its treaties, this savings clause that says, if you're a US citizen, you're always subject to US tax and you can't use the residence tiebreaker. And not only can't you use that, you can't use vast swathes of the treaty. There's certain it limits you to being able to use only some very specific parts of the treaty to reduce your US tax liability.
Can I ask you a very focused question? Is it your view that the effect of the saving clause is actually to facilitate double taxation?
Yeah. Well, it's to facilitate being subject to two different sets of tax law, which will inevitably be incompatible in places, leading to double taxation.
Do you agree with that, Laura?
Yes, it's this true specifically for Americans who live in other countries. So, yeah, that's the purpose, to single out people. Not all, not everybody, just people of a particular nationality for different treatment.
So the problem is, I think, that so we start with a saving clause that says, well, hey, US citizens don't get the benefit of the treaty anyway. And then we provide some exceptions to that where US citizens do get the benefit of the treaty. Karen, would it be possible to modify the exceptions to the saving clause in a way that US citizens who are tax residents of other countries could use the treaty to cease being dual tax residents?
Yeah, if you allow people to use the residence tiebreaker, you put it down in the exceptions, that would take care of it for people who are resident in the treaty partner. But yeah, the whole point of this savings clause is so that the US can enforce citizenship taxation. And without it, you really can't. And yeah, so all these other countries that say, oh, the US has it right, we should do citizenship taxation. Well, they don't have the network of tax treaties that allows them to enforce it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And then, of course, moving a step further on this, so the saving clause allows the U.S. to enforce citizenship taxation, but then what the U.S. does is adopts what's effectively a completely different and new enhanced set of tax rules that apply mostly to U.S. citizens living outside the United States and they're being punitive, right?
So you talk about in the tax code itself, it all of the xenophobic provisions. It says if it's foreign, we're going to tax it more punitively, add more penalties for not reporting, etc. Things like controlled foreign corporations, passive foreign investment companies.
Yeah, so the way it works, it seems to me, is you start off with citizenship taxation. And as I think we all agree, citizenship taxation just means that a country can tax its non-resident citizens. That's the only thing it really means. Then what you do is you write a treaty with a saving clause where significantly the other country agrees to allow the U.S. to tax the other country's residents who happen to be U.S. citizens. Yes?
Right.
And then to bring it home, so to speak, what you do is you write a set of very punitive tax laws that go after the assets and income streams of U.S. citizens that are not U.S. source, i.e., the assets and income streams of people who live in other countries who are U.S. citizens. Is that a fair way of viewing it?
Right. And then those rules are generally incompatible with the tax incentives that are have been passed by the treaty partner.
So, Laura, a really good example of that would be the in many countries, the exemption from capital gains tax on the sale of a principal residence, right?
Yep.
Okay. So would both of you agree that, given that the topic is what can other countries do, the first step would be to renegotiate the exceptions to the saving clause, right? Because I mean, what that does is it allows the US to continue to tax its citizens, but prevents them from taxing citizens who are residents of other countries, right? So, I'm not sure that,
Yeah.
but I mean, that certainly would be a help. What could a country do, possibly in response to a specific thing like the US taxation of a capital gain on a principal residence? If you were running the country, what response to that could you imagine?
Well, you could write a law that says that to the extent that you have to pay tax on this in another country, we're going to make it taxable here.
Interesting idea. What do you think about that, Laura? Amending the Income Tax Act of Canada to say there's an exemption from taxation on the sale of a principal residence unless you're a U.S. citizen. What do you think about that?
Wouldn't say necessarily unless you're a US citizen. I'd say, if you any tax owed on the sale of your Canadian principal residence to another country, Canada is hereby imposing an equal tax in Canada.
Okay. What do you think of
Now,
that, Laura?
presumably, I'm just thinking this through and thinking out loud now, but presumably that would either mostly or exclusively apply to Americans.
Right.
I think it probably would, yeah.
So, this is one of those ways where you are discriminating based on nationality without saying you're discriminating based on nationality.
Yeah.
But they've already done that through the FACA IGAs.
Yep,
And through
absolutely.
the savings clause.
Yeah.
So,
Karen, have you ever heard of what's called a soak-up tax?
I have not heard of a specific one in action, but I think I've heard of the theory.
Yeah, the theory is that, if another country creates a tax just to create a tax credit, so to speak, right, then they won't give the tax credit. But that aside, I mean, I think that's an interesting response, isn't it? Right? Say, well, the problem that the government of Canada or another country has is that, it's not so much the taxation, it's that the taxation is being used to siphon Canadian capital to the United States only because it's somebody, because it's a US citizen, right?
Could also make it illegal to pay tax to another country on Canadian source income.
The Canadian source income that's not taxed by Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's all
Well, you know what?
interesting.
If they tax Canadian source income that's taxed by Canada, you don't want another country to be putting a higher tax rate on it to collect tax
Yeah,
as well.
that too.
So, just make it illegal to pay tax to another country on Canadian source income. Then US citizens would be caught between a rock and a hard place. They would either have to, violate Canadian law by paying tax to the US or violate US law by not paying tax to the US.
Then you're absolutely driving people to either go back to the US or renounce. Because
Right.
there you would give people absolutely no choice.
Well, if
Because
we're
you'd
looking at
almost
this
be
from a
making it
point,
criminal. You'd be making it almost criminal to be an American outside the United States if you did that.
but it already is in some places. I mean, there are all kinds of stories about U.S. citizens have to break foreign currency laws to pay their U.S. taxes.
Or privacy laws to fill out their FBAR.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is going on all the time, but I mean, we're not looking at this at the moment. As I understand this, we're looking at this from the perspective of violation of the sovereignty of the country and what is the country supposed to do? I mean, to some extent, by signing these, well, to a large extent, by signing the FATCA IGAs, what the countries have done is made discrimination against U.S. citizens legal, right?
Well, that discriminated against U.S. citizens themselves. But yes,
Well,
they've made
absolutely.
it
Look,
legal for their banks to discriminate against U.S. citizens.
well, actually, on that topic, on the fact of IGAs, let me introduce this as a possible response to this. We've talked about this before from time to time. There's a really, really good paper written by Professor Allison Christians at McGill. Came out in 2017. It's a really, really good discussion of citizenship taxation. And one of the points that she makes, and I think that this is right, is that the FATCA IGAs are extensions, right, or premised on these tax treaties that the US has with other countries. And the information exchange provisions always have an exception for reasons of public policy.
Yep.
And it really seems to me that it is completely contrary to public policy for a country to send tax information about its citizen residents, where they do live, to a country where they don't live, the United States. Why shouldn't these countries just take the position, well, sure, I mean, we'll go along with this FATCA thing to the extent that involves U.S. citizens who are not our residents. But once
Yeah.
they are residents, no, that's contrary to public policy. And, clearly under the tax treaty, we're permitted to decide that. What
Yep.
about that?
I think that's spot on, and I don't think any other country will agree with it.
I think the answer to that is it's a bigger problem of public policy to try and stand up to the hegemonic United States. That's a much bigger public policy problem.
Okay. Well, then it seems to me that what the countries need to do is rid themselves of U.S. citizens, right?
Well, that would support their typical response to this, which is, why don't you just renounce?
Yeah. Well, what about now renunciation is a problem, right? It's they're clearly artificially reducing the opportunities to renounce worldwide. I mean, it takes over a year to get an appointment in Canada. I mean, it's obvious that they're artificially reducing the opportunities to renounce. What about other countries simply stepping up and saying, look, we really can't have these U.S. citizens living in our country. It's a problem for us. We'd like to just simply offer you something equivalent to a buyback program, where we're just going to put these people on a list. They're going to agree to it. We'll do it at a reduced fee. You'll make some money by selling off your citizens. We'll solve our problem. What do you think of that?
Mass renunciations.
Well, yeah, a mass pronunciation, a mass, sorry, but frame it in terms of like a buyback program.
You know what this sounds like? Sounds like, the during World War II when they would, massively revoke people's citizenships so that to keep them from coming back or, to keep that. I mean, how can you not relate that to that?
I
I mean, that's
do
such a
relate it to
massive
that.
violation. That's a massive violation of human rights.
I do relate it to that, absolutely, Laura. My point is simply this, that the U.S. extraterritorial tax regime is forcing the violation of rights. It's forcing it. That's my point here.
Yeah, it is.
So I mean, why not? Instead of pretending that, well, this really is just a local problem with the United, it has nothing to do with us, it doesn't have any violation of human rights at all. Why not just cut that crap out of the discussion and say, yeah, it's pretty clear that the U.S. extraterritorial tax regime is designed to and facilitates the violation of human rights all around the world. We didn't start it, there's nothing we can do about it, but we can't be victimized by it. Why should we treat U.S. citizens better than the U.S. is willing to treat its own citizens? I mean, that's kind of an interesting question, isn't it?
They do. They have, these other countries do have their own charters and constitutions, and they've signed up to human rights, international human rights instruments that say that they will not only themselves not discriminate based on nationality, but they will protect their people from discrimination based on nationality. That's what they have signed up to do in those documents. They
But
have a
in
duty.
fact, IGAs and the saving clause of the tax treaties, they've specifically agreed to the opposite.
Well, the IGAs, well, yeah, I guess so.
I mean, this is the problem, okay? I mean, you can't, it's sort of like, it's like these countries are in a position of trying to suck and blow at the same time. The sense that, by God, yes. We're going to discriminate against U.S. against our people who are U.S. citizens because they're U.S. citizens. But we actually have a commitment to all these human rights documents that prohibit discrimination based on nationality. I mean, how can both these things exist?
Oh, obviously, one answer to that is they can exist if you as the representative of your country aren't doing your job.
Well, so the topic here is what can these countries do? At present they appear to not be inclined to do anything at all. But here, let me throw this one out. I'd be interested in your reactions to this. Now, one of the things that is interesting. We've talked about the problem of small business corporations, people who are US citizens running businesses through small business corporations. The Treasury regulations actually contain a list of countries and various types of corporations in their countries. And some of these they define as per se corporations. And interestingly, almost all Canadian-controlled private corporations, for example, are defined as per se corporations, meaning, and this is what hurt Canadians so significantly with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, right? Things like GILTI transition tax, et cetera. And I don't see anything at all, right, that would force, very small Canadian businesses who are running through corporations to be treated as per se corporations when they're sort of equivalent types of things in other countries, run by everyday people, where they're not per se corporations and therefore they can opt to be treated as a pass-through, et cetera. Now, my question is, I mean, this is clearly idiotic. Okay, it is clearly idiotic. No understanding what any of this stuff is. Should countries take the initiative to go to the US Treasury and say, leaving aside all this other garbage, how dare you characterize this small dance school in Canada as a per se corporation, treating it as though it's some kind of a multinational? What about that?
Yeah, I think they ought to be, but they won't because they'll say it's up to the US to determine their own tax laws. But, how does the IRS know what the legal structures are in 200 other countries that they can put together a regulation that says which ones are per se corporations?
Well,
Doesn't that sound like arrogance to you?
it sounds, well, I don't think it sounds like arrogance. I mean, it just sounds like tremendous, unawareness, stupidity, not understanding what the impact of that type of thing would be. I think
Yeah.
clearly, this was done in 1996, right?
Right.
But again, we're talking about what can and should other countries do. I mean, my personal opinion, and I emphasize my personal opinion, is the Department of Finance in Canada should get the people at US Treasury on the phone and say, look, leaving aside our view of your citizenship taxation regime, you really should not be characterizing every single corporate form in Canada run by your everyday person as a per se corporation. Why don't we work with you to get this definition changed better? What about that?
I mean, I think it would help a lot of Canadians, wouldn't it?
Well, is that something that countries ought to be doing? In other words, paying attention to how the US characterizes under its domestic tax laws entities in other countries, when they're naming
Well,
them by name.
Australia should be doing the same with superannuation, shouldn't they?
I agree totally. I 100% agree. And here's a way around this, right? And it's this. So superannuations presumably are exempt from reporting under the FATCA IGAs, right?
Right.
So what about, say, look, we know Treasury that, this is a big job, et cetera, but really, in many ways, it's already been done because every country the US has an IGA with includes the types of entities that don't have to be reported, right? So, what about if it doesn't have to be reported, then it's not subject to this kind of punitive taxation, et cetera? What about that as a backdoor thing that countries might be able to do?
Yeah, if it doesn't have to be reported, then it should be taxable only by the company that the country that set it up or where
Right.
it's located.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, isn't that something though? Isn't that something that a country could do here? And I think should do.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something you could stick in the treaty next time you renegotiate it.
You don't even need to put it in the treaty. What you need is for the US to simply recognize that if it already fits in under the FATCA, IGAs is not reportable, then it shouldn't be subject to these other punitive types of rules, right?
Yep.
But I mean, I'm just
Good
trying
luck.
to focus on things that the countries can do, right? Which as I understand, is what we're talking about today. What do you think about that, Laura?
Sure. It's, there's always the big question of, the real problem is the system itself, and the real solution is to stop this taxation of people based on citizenship. If you're saying, okay, put that aside, let's look at what specific smaller fixes may or may not be doable, well, then sure. And then there's probably a long list of things like that that you could probably come up with. for example, stop taxing welfare benefits. I would think other countries should be livid at the fact that, any welfare benefits that they're granting their residents that the country itself doesn't tax, and that those are benefits they know that their residents need, that they're in a position of need, and so they need that. And the United States comes and taxes that. They should be outraged by that and should be doing everything to stop that. Sure, but yeah.
Well, yes, they should be doing that. And the question is how to get them to, to start doing that. I mean, the overall theme here is that this is not just an issue with the United States. This is not go talk to the United States. Okay? This is a combination of countries stepping up to the plate to protect their own residents, but also a recognition that this is hurting. This is a direct attack on the tax base of other countries. Any US citizen living outside the United States as a tax resident of another country is simply an instrument of base tax erosion. That's all they are because of this problem. Once you let a US citizen into the country and live there, you're actually opening the door to, part of your economy being subject to US taxation, right?
Right.
So, should countries stop allowing US citizens to immigrate?
Course, that's discriminating on the basis of nationality as well.
Okay. But really, now where we are in the conversation is only the United States can discriminate on the basis of nationality. Other countries can't. This sounds like the rules-based international order, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So how do you get countries aware of this? What should be done, Laura?
Well, there's people that are trying to do this with, more or less success. Karen is and others in Australia are trying to make Australian authorities aware. You've got Fabian, people like Fabian, people like Jenny in the UK, talking to people, lawsuits. Fabian's filed a lot of lawsuits. It's hard, they are aware. They are aware. It's just not a battle they want to fight.
That's right. They just don't want to fight it.
Long run, do they have a choice, though? Can they ignore this long run? Because sooner or later, the extraterritorial application of these laws will completely end these countries' status as sovereign countries.
Say on many levels, this has already happened. People talk about Europe as a vassal state of the United States. It's the hegemonic power of the United States that at some point you either completely give in to, or you finally stand up and really, take a stand against it. Neither of those things is happening now, or I guess you could argue that there is certainly tending towards the acquiescence.
Well, I think that is probably right. Well, under your looking at your paper here, Laura, so I think we've kind of I think do you agree that we've talked about a number of the issues raised in your paper?
Yes, the only thing I would add for people who, want to, know more about this, the paper concludes with quotes from people who have participated in Seat's 2001, 2021 survey. People, living in different countries, explaining basically how they are, in their own way, how they are unable to fully live in the place where they live, how that they are unable to fully contribute either economically or socially to the place where they live because of these laws. So there's about 12, 13 pages of quotes from people from, I don't remember exactly how many, maybe about 20, 25 countries, kind of, trying to personalize, what this problem is, and in a way that, this is how people, governmental representatives in other countries should be understanding what's really going on here. That this is not about paying a tax. This is about much, much more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any particular quotes you'd like to end with today? A few things you might want to read into the podcast or
Gosh, you can almost dive in here and pick anyone. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, I have refrained. This is someone in Israel. I've refrained from opening a business and becoming a freelancer because of taxation. In Hong Kong, my girlfriend does not want to marry me because I'm a US citizen. She does not, yeah, because she does not want to have commingled assets with me. I am disadvantaged in the labor market because many employers do not want the complexity of a US citizen as an employee. This is someone in Germany. Frustrates me that though I am 26 and hopefully have a long and prosperous life ahead of me, I have to consider the tax implications of retaining my US citizenship when it comes to life milestones such as investments, such as real estate, getting married, raising a family, and otherwise managing my finances and student loans. This is someone in France. I'm unable to prepare for my retirement as well as I could have, given US tax treatment of the most common retirement investment options in the country where I live. Certainly could go on. Like I said, there's 12, 13 pages. And these are just, these are just things that I selected from the 700 pages of the full comments that you'll find on the SEAT website with, that has all of the comments from all of the participants.
I get the feeling from listening to those comments, quotes, that citizens of the land of the free don't really think they're all that free.
You are, if you are an American, you're not free to live in outside the United States. You're not, you can leave the country. There's no, nothing's going to stop you physically at the border, but you can't really have a life outside. And in fact, that's an interesting statement. There was a Monmouth University, they do those polls about 10 days ago or so. They published the results of another poll in which one third, or 34% of the people they polled said that they want to settle. This is the word they use. They want to settle outside the United States. And I thought that that was very interesting, that, that terminology, because what you see here, what's happening here, is you cannot settle outside the United States. That is exactly what is happening to these people. They cannot settle. Can they physically leave the country? Sure. Can they settle in another country? No. If you want to settle in another country, you're really settled, you're going to have to renounce your citizenship. So by definition, Americans aren't free to do that. And apparently one third of the Americans living in the United States today want to do that. They don't know that they can't.
They've not heard of the invisible fence.
Bars.
Are there, do you know, if there are citizens of any other countries that have this problem?
To this extent, no.
To
I
any
mean, people,
extent.
well, people will, talk about Eritrea. Hungary's got a limited form of citizenship taxation. Myanmar, what's the other one? No, I think that's it. Hungary, Eritrea, and Myanmar. But Hungary's has got a lot of exceptions. So I imagine it applies to very few people. And Myanmar's, I don't remember the specifics of Myanmar's. Eritrea's is not as complex as the United States is. It's enforced in a very brutal way, which of course isn't acceptable. The tax itself just not is not a constraint on your life like the American tax.
Karen, any closing comments on that, particularly on the, are citizens of the land of the free, in a relative sense, free compared to citizens of other countries?
Look, it's clear that the U.S. citizenship makes it very difficult to settle outside of the U.S. And as you've said many times, all roads lead to renunciation.
On that note, unless, of course, it's possible to stop extraterritorial American taxation now, right?
That's what we want.
Right.
And to learn more, visit our site at seatnow.org, SEATNOW.org, which includes all these working papers and more. All right. Any final comments, Karen, Laura?
Well, I think we've covered it, John.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.